last week, Paulo Figueiredo. He is basically the Joe Rogan of Brazil, because I wanted to shed some light on what's going on in Brazil right now. We're also working on getting Javier Bolsonaro. I always call him Bolsonaro. So we're working on a couple of things as it relates to Brazil, but you'll really enjoy the interview. It's coming out next week, and there's a huge problem there, because Lula is now the president, and he is a communist, and many people feel that the election was rigged. It's a big freaking mess. All right, we got one more for you.
Welcome, 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 folks, to Left Reckoning 169, where we say Lulu Livre. I'm joined, as always, by my good friend, Matt Black. How are you doing, brother?
Lulu Livre to you, David. The horrible dictator Lulu continues his reign, and, you know, we support it here.
I'm seeing Lulu everywhere these days, actually. We are going to be joined in just a little bit by our good buddy, Paul Prescott. You know Paul from places like Jacobin Magazine, from places like The Jacobin Show, one of our favorites, RIP, and also from Damage Magazine, where he has a really great piece on institutional racism. Always a great pleasure to speak with Paul. So you want to make sure that you stay tuned for that. And then we have some wild news. Out of the state of Texas. I mean, it's pretty rare on the show that we don't have something absolutely ridiculous and horrifying.
When David told me about the angle of attack we now have against charter schools, I like almost squealed. Like, yeah. It's the juiciest over the plate, off speed pitch like Sammy Sosa ever saw in 1996.
It is a true tremendous gift. So we'll be getting into all that in just a little bit. But before we get there, I want to talk a little bit about love. As people know, I'm recently married, so love is on the mind. But I want to talk about something serious for a second, because while I know it can sometimes seem a little bit old-fashioned and these kind of anxieties around technology and capitalism and our relationships, this is something that is very, very worrying. Because as we see more and more aspects of our life become commodified, become data, become things for other people to observe and control, it has significant consequences for the rest of us out here in society. And this video here, I think people were rightfully dogging on, but it really does highlight, I think, some of the nastiest and most dangerous kind of new conceptions of love relationships. Particularly the commodification and the over technological view of love. Let's play this for a second. This is from the CEO of Bumble. And, I will admit I have not been on these platforms. So please, Matt, fill me in anywhere. I don't know if you've been on these platforms either. Fill me in anywhere.
I have been on Bumble, actually. Yeah. I believe that's the one where you have the women message first, but maybe that was, back a while back. I'm not sure how recent policy is.
No, and that is exactly right. And the whole thing is to promote kind of like a very specific view of relationships. Of course, right? Not something that's happening, I don't know, in a social sphere, in a cultural sphere, but something that is a for-profit business. This for-profit business is now very interested in utilizing certain new technologies, ones that Matt and I love to talk about this program, namely artificial intelligence, to heavily involve themselves in how folks interact with each other. Let's introduce this really quick.
And how much is AI going to help or hurt that? Because, you and I talked about last year, AI might be able to help teach you how to flirt, help you write that opening message. On the other hand, you've got like people falling in love with bots and like bots posing as real people.
Yes.
Like, this is getting really terrifying.
Yes, it's a little freaky, but that's a fad. I mean, listen, I'm sure there are people out there that might form friendships with some form of AI, and that's fine. But our focus with AI is to help create more healthy and equitable relationships. And that also starts with yourself. How can we actually teach you how to date? How can we help you show up in a better way? How
so give me an example.
Okay, so for example, you could in the near future be talking to your AI dating concierge, and you could share your insecurities. I just came out of a breakup. I have commitment issues. And it could help you train yourself into a better way of thinking about yourself. And then it could give you productive tips for communicating with other people. If you want to get really out there, there is a world where your dating concierge could go and date for you with other dating concierge. No, truly. And then you don't have to talk to 600 people. It will just scan all of San Francisco for you and say, these are the three people you really ought to meet. And so, you know, that's the power of AI.
So just want to note, thank God that even in that crowd, that suggestion was treated as the laughable one that it is.
Yeah.
But yeah, Matt, I mean, I'm curious. I know, you know, I'm curious if you have any thoughts here before I dive in.
I mean, a few things off the topic. First of all, after every mass shooting in this country known for them, we hear politicians be like, yeah, they've got to do this mental health stuff. But apparently it's also useful as just something you can point to that a computer chip's going to solve through your product that you just happen to sell. Yeah, that's what people need is it, to the extent like you're going through a breakup and have certain things you need to work through. You don't need an AI being like, well, here's how your damage matches up according to our algorithm. That's not going to be it at all. Your dating concierge just like, again, like, and we see this in every, like, I remember, like the long questionnaires filled out for like OkCupid and stuff like that. And it's like, ultimately none of those relationships ever stuck. I know plenty of people do have relationships like that, but I think what my experience is with people that have relationships that start on these kind of apps, you have a sense that they worked out in spite of the app. Like you could have met anywhere. You could have met through some other circumstance through friends and it would have been the exact same way. But that isn't really like a value proposition to investors or like tech companies or something like that.
No. And that's, I think that's 100% correct, Matt, right? It's not that it's impossible for anyone to ever find love, just like it's possible, for example, for you to find love at work, right? A place that is, you know, tremendously dictatorial. You know, so it's not saying, oh, there's a right or is a correct or an incorrect way to find somebody. In fact, it's these kind of mentalities that we're seeing from the Silicon Valley class that wants to have a lot of influence over how you date, how you interact with people, who are saying that there is correct and incorrect ways to meet.
Yep.
Where you really see this ideology get really toxic and dangerous is one, this kind of over-marketization of the self. And in this way, in a kind of very intimate and very basic human level, on the level of like romance and intimacy, where, you know, what do these kind of apps, what do these kind of systems try to encourage you to do? Well, they encourage you to present yourself almost like a product that you are advertising to a large group of potential buyers. And I'm not going to get into the kind of economics of how these platforms work, but it is a really nasty neoliberal perversion of very, very basic human instincts. Add to that, the fact that there's an encouragement here for people to share like their intimate fears and insecurities with the Bumble Corporation. Let's just say this again. This is a private corporation being like, hey, will you tell me about your personal relationship insecurities? One, just how perverse and wrong that is. Let's also not forget that, you know, data security is something that we have seen these kind of companies fail time and time again. Let's not forget the most probably famous and consequential for folks, one being Ashley Madison, a site where people could cheat on their wives, where there was a massive data breach that led to people, you know, to committing suicide. I mean, seriously, you know, life and death kind of consequences with this kind of thing. And the last thing too, is it's just like, this is where I might get a little philosophical for folks, but as a, you know, as a romantic, as somebody who does like philosophy, I've always been struck by the work of Alain Badiou, who I think is probably one of the best Marxist philosophers on the question of love ever. And, you know, he's been writing about this before we had this kind of perverted thing of like, AI concierge dating. So you don't have to go through the hassle of maybe having a conversation that doesn't go well. Or, you know, pursuing a love.
Yeah, sorry. That's the process of getting yourself into like shape of like building a personality is like those fits and starts of like, oh, that wasn't a great date. What did I do wrong there? Like you cannot protect yourself from life.
100%. And do you know who else isn't interested in protecting you, your kind of immortal soul? The bosses. So why is there this kind of worry about like the dangerous and nasty parts of love, right? Well, it's because love is something that is incredibly interrupting to one thing that capitalists care a lot about, your productivity. And man, falling in love can cause a lot of problems to how productive you are at work, and hell, falling out of love can cause a lot of problems for how, you know, you are, you know, how productive you are at work. And the real irony, as like Alan Badu in his work in Praise of Love sort of lays out, just talking about these dating apps in general, is that we are at a moment where it's probably easier than ever before to meet people, right? In the sense of like, you can go on, I can go on my cell phone and, you know, try to find some level of communication with other folks. And yet people feel more alienated and isolated than ever. And it's because, one, the social space has been completely commodified, has been completely limited by capital. And two, all of these avenues that we have for human connection are in themselves just products. And either you are the one creating the data, the interaction for these companies. None of these things are about setting up like actual human experiences. But they're also, because they are products, they set up these kind of guardrails. This is Bumble's whole thing. This is a lot of these apps' whole thing. It's like, what if you could fall in love without dangerous aspects, the tedious aspects? Hell, spending a lot of time looking for a partner or going on bad dates. Well, we don't have to do that. We can just sort of chat at home. Nobody has to go out and have these kind of things. Effectively, they want, these companies are trying to sell us love without the fall. And what that means is like falling in love is something that is incredibly violent. And I use this in the more poetic form. Right? It's violent in the sense that it interrupts your life. It interrupts everything about your life. And that's something that folks do not see. The thing of like torture.
Sorry, you were just cutting out for a split second there. I'm not sure what was going on.
Is it better now?
Better now, yep.
You know, the thing of poetry, of art, of music, of literature, is this kind of violent falling in love. And it's something that all of these companies are trying to rob from us. So, you know, it's funny when it's AI, right? Because it's just so ludicrous to say, hey, we're actually going to outsource everything about your life to a computer program. But don't forget that it's all of these guardrails that they're trying to put on you and all these limitations of the human experience that are being, you know, all these things that have been robbed to us by neoliberal capitalism being packaged together in a kind of hollow, empty form, put in a nice bundle and sold back to you, maybe for a monthly subscription.
Does anybody listening to this think that any app will ever do more for the love lives of you and those around you than more money in your pocket on Friday and maybe 5 hours working less that week will do? Nah, no app's ever going to remotely give you that. Like if we just had a, like, I don't know. I remember 10 years ago being in London, working in there as a fact checker. Every Friday, we left the office at noon and just drank in the pub and socialized the whole time. Like and we were surrounded in those pubs by like other people who were doing the same thing. That sort of culture like needs to be encouraged more. It's not going to be some fancy little way of swiping. Like, let's get real. It's we know what it takes, and it is being around other people and not having to worry about, you know, how much you're spending or when you need to get back in time so you can get up to work the next morning.
Yeah. And people need, you know, community and socialization. And it reminds me of something that our friend Paul Prescott wrote about when they were writing their review of Tony Mazzocchi's life and work, about how the bowling parties that the union that Tony Mazzocchi was an organizer with would throw, and how it was a really great place to meet people and fall in love. And that's not too on the nose of a segue. Let me introduce that man himself, Paul Prescott. Paul, how are you doing, friend?
I'm great. Great to be here.
Well, we're stoked to have you, and you know, always great chatting with you. And it's funny that I'm sorry, we just had a little crosstalk. I think it's settled now. But anyways, we're not going to talk about love. We're not going to talk about all this kind of stuff. We're going to talk about cold, hard systems here. Paul, people know Paul from The Jacobin Show, from Jacobin Magazine, as well as Damage and their work with TDU, Teamsters for a Democratic Union. We're going to be talking about this piece that Paul wrote in the second issue of Damage Magazine called Going Beyond the Politics of Institutional Racism. Maybe to kick us off a little bit, Paul, do you think you could help us understand what it is exactly that people that you're critiquing here mean by institutional racism? Because it's one of those terms that I think most people sort of use as shorthand for a bad thing. What's the difference between institutional racism and, let's say, you know, just old-fashioned, old-school racism?
Yeah. I think maybe the way to answer this is to kind of go into how I came across the term institutional racism. So, you know, I kind of got involved in politics and the left in the, 2010. And I think I came across this term sometime in the 2010s. And, you know, at first, I think it kind of satisfied a need I was looking for. Is like, how can we explain racial, inequality in society today that goes beyond just like an individual saying a racial slur? And that's kind of what attracted me to it. And I think that's what kind of attracts some people to it. So I think the idea, and I'll go into this more, I think when the term was first coined, there was a better idea behind it. And I think what's happened over time, it's kind of morphed into something else. It's become more and more meaningless. But I think the best version of the term is describing racial inequality beyond individual acts of racism, beyond individual prejudice. How do the institutions in our society kind of reproduce racial inequality? That's, I think, the good version of the term. But what I argue in the piece is, like, even at the beginning, it had its limits the way it was conceptualized. And I think today it's kind of become something totally different than what it was supposed to be originally.
Yeah, I mean, it's always interesting to see how, like, much slippage there is on a lot of terms from this kind of very truly radical time to today. Maybe to start getting us into it a little bit, the difference between, like, so institutional racism is supposedly, something that is sort of, as you were saying, like reproducing a kind of racist structure in society. But like, how does that sort of, how would that sort of operate functionally in a kind of day-to-day basis? Like, what are the kind of things that we might look at and point at, say, are institutional racist? Because today, this is something that the right, always loves to sort of meme the left, saying, oh, the left thinks everything is racist. Because you can come up with some comical examples of people on Twitter who will say, this kind of thing is racist or that kind of thing is racist. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, and I think this is where it gets tricky, because I think the problem has become what is showing up as racial inequality. And, you can't deny it. I mean, you look at disparities in healthcare, housing, whatever, they're there. No one seeks to deny them. Even the so-called class reductionists wouldn't seek to deny them. But I think the problem becomes, even though these things are showing up as racial disparities, their root causes are actually in the function of capitalism. And I think that kind of starts to confuse cause and effect. So I think, for an example, looking at public education in this country, the state of schools in predominantly Black neighborhoods, Black urban centers, compared to, maybe more wealthy, more white suburban areas, that I think has been used as an example of institutional racism. Disparities in health outcomes, in housing, all these kinds of things, I think would be cited as institutional racism. And I think, when the term first was coined, as I go into the piece, I think the first time people articulated it was in the work Black Power of 1967. So Black Power as a phrase was kind of coined in 1966 by Stokely Carmichael, who was active with SNCC. He partnered with Charles Hamilton, a political scientist, to write this book, Black Power. And it was kind of the first exposition of, like, what do we mean by this term? Because from the beginning, this term kind of meant many different things to many different people. I'll say this, I definitely have a critique of Black Power advocates of that era, and I have a critique of this book. But if you compare what they were saying to people like Ibram X. Kendi today, I mean, their level of analysis is much better, much rooted in material concerns than is today. So, you know, they start out by kind of being clear, like, you know, if a white racist blows up a black church, you know, most people will condemn that as racism. But in that same town, you know, you look at infant mortality for blacks being, you know, triple, quadruple that of whites. That's something that happens just quietly in the backdrop, but no one is going to condemn. That's kind of like the function of the system of institutional racism. So, you know, this is the kind of thing like it would sound like, well, yeah, of course, this is like exactly what the left is talking about. What is wrong with this? But I think when you start to see, at least in the book originally, the problems start to arise when they're talking about solutions. So it's kind of this letdown of describing these structural forces. And when it comes to this section of, you know, what do we do about it? It's like, well, we got to reclaim Black cultural pride. There's a big movement around community control of schools, especially at this time. And, you know, the basis for that, I don't think was totally unfounded. I mean, it was this idea, you know, we have mostly Black students being taught by almost all white teachers, Black parents not having input. But again, I think that kind of misses the fundamental point, and it actually misses the institutional nature of, you know, you could have Black parents control the school, you could have more Black teachers, but if these schools are still getting less resources, if they're still not getting the funding they need, that control doesn't really mean much. That, you know, having more cultural pride is actually not an institutional solution, as opposed to like having, you know, universal healthcare or universally funded public education. So I think that's where the confusion of institutional racism comes. So, you know, it was flawed from the beginning, but I think now that we come to today, it's really thrown around. You know, it used to be kind of a term more in academia. Now it's kind of just thrown around, like you could listen to daytime radio, The View. They probably say it all the time on The View. It's kind of just thrown out there, and it's, I think, now a shorthand for disparities. And again, the disparities are real, but I think you can miss the cause of the disparities if you're only looking at as racial disparities.
Yeah, you know, Pete Buttigieg, who I don't consider to be a liberatory politician, will mention, I think, one of the common examples of this, which I remember reading about, Robert Moses and the bridges that were too low for public buses to pass underneath, as an example of systemic racism. And I wonder if, you know, I'm trying to think of the example that I learned from that, which is like, damn, we can't let guys like Robert Moses be in charge of this sort of development policy. And then you realize like, oh, this didn't just happen in New York. This happened all around. So is that one of the problems with this type of analysis, that it individualizes like the culprit too much?
Yeah, and I think ironically, especially these days, it does, because, I mean, what is the focus? I mean, people like Ibram X. Kendi, Robin DiAngelo, I mean, those are like the worst offenders, but these kinds of people will use institutional racism as a phrase all day long. But it's kind of ironic, because what are their solutions? Their solutions are all individual based, like become less racist, you know, read the right text, improve your interpersonal reactions, which is really not an institutional solution at all. And, you know, and again, it's tricky, because even though something shows up as a racial disparity, there are other factors which I really think are more of like a political economic cause of these disparities. You know, I think a great example is looking post 1960s, what is happening in urban Black communities. You know, again, you see an acceleration of disparities, but you know what is happening. You have the mechanization of agriculture in the South driving, you know, Black Southerners to move to these northern cities, right at the same time where in these northern cities you have automation, you have the movement of jobs to the suburbs and to the South and overseas. You know, you have the destruction of unions. So, you know, that is not necessarily racism causing all of that. I mean, these are larger political economic features. But if your diagnosis is this is racism, you're going to look for a race-based solution, when I think there's kind of a broader solution that needs to be sought.
Yeah, I mean, I think this sort of gets to the heart here, is that the framework of institutional racism, it's sort of, again, like it points to existing things that are happening in society, actual disparities between folks. But again, instead of pointing to like the concrete reality as to why that's happening, it becomes, well, there's a racism problem, which again, it becomes kind of moral. And in fact, the way a lot of the people talk about it today, Kendi's, the D'Angelo's, like a spiritual problem that sort of needs to be met with like repentance instead of like an actual like material solution to the disparity in American society.
Right. And, you know, there's no better way to test this out than in a real, when a real life movement emerges. And for me, the real tell became with both Bernie Sanders campaigns. You know, the people that would use this kind of rhetoric, and to be clear, I'm not saying the average Black voter, you know, I pretty much try to say this on every podcast I go into because it's just worth remembering. But remember, in 2020, Bernie Sanders did second best among Black voters to Joe Biden. And if you look at Black voters 35 and under, Bernie Sanders was first. So not really the average Black voter, but again, these kind of like pundit, certain pundit figures, certain academia figures who utilize this rhetoric. I mean, here we are confronted with a movement, the Bernie Sanders movement. And it's funny because his platform almost was identical to the freedom budget that Byrd Rustin and A. Philip Randolph pushed in the mid 60s. I mean, dealing with the fundamental institutions of our society, healthcare, the economy, education, housing. I mean, this was it. And it was met by these kinds of people with skepticism, hostility, all these kinds of things. And it's like, well, I mean, what would have addressed the institutions of our society? So I think that was a big tell that it's really not about that. And it's, you know, now when this rhetoric is utilized, I don't think people are really looking at taking an institutional approach. And, you know, I say in the piece, I mean, it's like, I'm no big fan of police, but if you're going to look at like a decrease in a police budget in some city somewhere and think that's like doing more to attack institutional racism than universal healthcare, you know, you're just wrong. So that was the real tell that I don't think the people pushing this are actually interested or aware of like what a real institutional approach would be.
You know, I'm curious what you think about this, Paul, because I think sometimes, you know, our audience on this program, you know, tends to be a bit younger. They you know, they should, and if they haven't, but they might not be, for example, familiar with like Adolf Reed's work. And sort of recognizing that like one of the struggles in America has been you have this like very radical, you know, revolutionary, in fact, you know, civil rights movement in this country. And then you have a period where you actually do have this development of like a Black political class that starts to run cities, that starts to run some of these institutions. And unfortunately, you know, did not necessarily lead, you know, to the kind of like, you know, emancipatory politics that, you know, folks might have hoped that, like, in fact, there are some things that are baked into the system of American capitalism and American government that seem to prefer the maintenance of a certain kind of underclass and underprivileged group of people.
Right. And, you know, it really is interesting looking into the debates of the time. Once this Black political class rose in the mid and late 60s and beyond in the 70s, you know, as I've looked at it more, I've actually found myself having much more sympathy and alignment with that first wave of Black political class, even more than the so-called Black radicals and nationalists. Because a big debate that played out was, again, this idea of local and community control. You know, Black nationalists pushing that. And, you know, the last piece I wrote or a few pieces ago was about the Gary National Convention, which was like a Black political convention in 1972, where it was basically every strand of Black ideologies in a room in a convention. But a debate that played out was this idea of local control. And a lot of these first Black mayors in major cities was like, look, what is local control going to get us? Because even as the mayor of Cleveland or the mayor of Gary, Indiana, I actually have no control over these major things because the actual resources are at the federal level, or like the major corporations hold the power. So if we limit our scope to local control, we're actually not going to be able to address you know, any of these issues. We need to go to the federal level. And many of that first wave, they would be a dream to have today, let's just say that, in terms of their social democratic politics. But it's also really interesting too, again, you kind of have this test case, because in the mid-60s, like I said, Black power, the term is coined in 1966. Carmichael and Hamilton write this book in 1967. And it's interesting because these Black Power radicals, they actually agreed with the Black Social Democrats like Randolph, Rustin, and King on this point. They both agreed that, like, you know, we passed all the civil rights legislation, but if you are a working class Black person in the urban North, this legislation is kind of meaningless. You know, I mean, you already, segregation already was not law. So they both agreed on that. But the question was, how do we address that? And right at the same time as you asked, that was kind of identical to the Bernie platform, universal healthcare, you know, full employment, universal housing. That was their idea of like, this is actually how we get out of this situation. And those are kind of where the paths diverged in the mid 60s.
You know, it really is sort of fascinating doing American history and seeing that, like, the fight over kind of small scale local politics versus people demanding mass politics is sort of like, that's like from the get go. And certainly hasn't gone away today.
Right.
We have this kind of issue, I think, both in like the historical record as we're talking about here, and then certainly in how it's like been playing out in American politics in the past few years. What can a solution to this be? And also, like, how can this be framed in a way? Because with people, there's going to be people who are going to listen to this segment, Paul, and you know it because you've been doing this enough, and they're going to hear, you know, Paul came on David and Matt's podcast to talk about how class is the only thing that matters and there isn't racism in America. I mean, you know, how can we actually build something, you know, that can actually seriously get at these kind of issues and also maybe frame it in a way that sort of gets out of this kind of tired framing?
Yeah. I mean, one thing that gives me hope, again, I think it's hard to remember because we, I think it's just human nature. We tend to dwell on the negative and what's getting the most attention. But again, I'm going back to the Bernie campaign. And when you kind of clear away the smoke, it's like, wait, hold up a minute. Actually, most regular Black people, and even more so, most regular Latinos, for example, really supported the Bernie platform. And we know this myth has been, you know, and I always ask people, I mean, because the establishment, of course, cynically were like, well, you know, Bernie, he didn't speak to issues of people of color. And that's why. And I always ask them, like, so really, so Biden was more woke than Bernie, really? That explains why he got more Black support? No, there's other political factors and structural factors going on. So that kind of is hopeful that actually, I think when you really take a step back, most people get it. And most people kind of support this universal approach. And, you know, Adolph Reed, you mentioned, he worked a lot on the Bernie campaign and labor for Bernie. He always has a story of, like, every time he would do events, almost inevitably there would be, you know, someone Black would stand up and say, well, like, what about, you know, racial issues? And sometimes genuinely, sometimes cynically. And his answer was always the same, like, well, let's go down the list. Like, how is a higher minimum wage not relevant to Black people? How is healthcare? How is jobs? And what he said is, when it came to ordinary people, most of them, their response was like, okay, yeah, that makes sense. It was only the cynical politicos that made it an issue. So I do think most people, and I think just being able to articulate clearly, I mean, A. Philip Randolph used to always say, like, look, I mean, at least 90% of Black people are working class, a higher proportion than whites. So of course unions are going to be relevant. And even to this day, I mean, Blacks are unionized at a higher rate than whites. So, you know, I think there's a way of, like, it's not dismissing, and again, there's no dismissing of the disparities, but it's like, let's think carefully of what's causing the disparity and the solution. You know, I mean, going back to this, again, this question about what happened to our urban centers with capital pulling out and jobs. Now, don't get me wrong. I have no doubt that the corporate elite in the 60s was probably full of a lot of racists. Don't get me wrong. But I don't think this was a matter of them getting in a room scheming, like, how can we screw over Black people today? It was, again, a function of them being capitalists and what made the most sense. And of course, we're seeing that, I mean, in white rural areas, a similar type of destruction. So, you know, just because you see this disparity doesn't mean it's always race is the cause or the solution. And this is the danger of going down the disparities drumbeat, because if you're framing that as the issue, you have to come up with neoliberal solutions. You know, so one example would be, if you find that in a certain industry, Black workers are disproportionately you know, have these lower paying jobs. So instead of thinking about, well, how do we make these bad jobs good jobs? Because, I mean, the factory jobs that became good jobs in the mid 20th century used to be horrible jobs. You can make them good jobs. Instead of thinking that, you're going to think about, well, how do we make sure the correct number of whites and blacks hold these bad jobs, you know, or it's coming to college admissions, instead of thinking about, well, how can we get the correct percentage of blacks in there? You know, how do we make it so that any person is not denied from going because of their means? So, you know, I think that's the framing. That's kind of how they approach. And again, it's easy to kind of lose sight that, like, normal people, I think most people get that. Even if someone might be skeptical initially, I think if you kind of talk rationally about it, most people get it. It's only these sickos in the media and the political class that kind of make it not make sense to people.
What's amazing with these, like, these politicos too, is like, they're losing, like, the black vote and the Hispanic vote all across the country. You know, so these race whisperers here are pretty bad at their job.
And this is the thing, I mean, I've been saying, I mean, isn't it amazing? I mean, the last 10 years, Democrat establishment have decided to go in on, like, you know, let's jack up the race rhetoric. Let's jack up on, like, woke signaling. Let's kneel down in kente cloth. And it's in this moment that you're starting to lose black support, which again, just speaks to this disconnect about how I think ordinary people of color are thinking about these issues and, you know, the political elites. But again, that's another, I mean, they now should have no credibility on this, because again, you are literally losing black voters and Hispanic voters for the first time in a very long time, right as you are jacking up this kind of way of looking at the problem. So, I mean, you know, all credibility is getting lost, I think, on this issue.
Well, so I have to ask you before, I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the exciting stuff, the union things that we've been saying. But, you know, going back to Bernie, who, you know, was not good at this, apparently, now we're getting things like this, and friend Bhaskar was tweeting about it. And I was just curious if I could get a little reaction from you on this, because Bernie Sanders is going to talk about healthcare in a very specific way that I think is, like, atypical for Bernie. This is a different version of Bernie. And, you know, I think we can all sort of admit we have been seeing a little bit of a different version of Bernie on a lot of factors in the past few months. But here's how I get your reaction to here, Paul.
When Black, Latino, and Native American patients have access to Black, Latino, and Native American doctors, their health outcomes substantially improve. They are more likely to receive preventative services, they are more satisfied with their care, and they are more likely to live longer and happier lives.
According to Sanders, the average...
I'm curious, Paul, if you have any kind of thoughts on that kind of line from Bernie, because again, I think it does, you know, sound markedly different, I think, than what we were talking about, like, you know, Adolf Reed would sort of note that Bernie Sanders would do on the campaign trail when he was running 16 and 20.
Yeah, I mean, I'll answer it this way. You know, first of all, I'm not deeply familiar with the studies in healthcare that are out there. So I know there are studies that are claiming that and are kind of harping on, like, you know, the difference in treatment, like if Black patients with Black doctors and things like that. So I'm not deeply familiar with all that literature, but I want to kind of go back to the outbreak of COVID. A really interesting and kind of, like, unsettling thing happened at the beginning of COVID. All these reports were coming out about, you know, Black people, Hispanic people disproportionately getting COVID more. And the way it was talked about was literally as if it was an issue of, there's a physical difference with African Americans, and, you know, their bodies are different, their blood is different, and they are more susceptible physically to COVID. So, like, in other words, like, literal race science. And this was just kind of coming out there, and I'm like, is anyone seeing what's going on here? Now, you know, people like Les Leopold and Adolf Reed, they did some more work in looking at the data, and they found that, like, okay, they were not parsing the data by class. So when you factored in class, you got a fuller picture. And over time, as COVID, you know, we were with it longer and got to study it more, you started to see the racial disparities even out by class. And, you know, it became a straightforward thing of, like, yeah, people, essential workers, disproportionately workers of color. You know, people without as good access to healthcare obviously were more susceptible. So this included, you know, in poor white area, white communities also had similar rates. So again, I would be, in terms of these studies and this idea today of like, you know, again, do I have an issue with more Black doctors? No, of course not. But in terms of this issue of, you know, the doctor being the determination, the race of the doctor being the determination of the treatment, I would really like to see, are these studies factoring in these, you know, these issues of like, you know, what kind of medical care are these patients receiving in general? You know, what is their socioeconomic background? Because as we saw with COVID, if you don't do that, you're going to get a very skewed picture, and it's going to lead you down some weird ideas like, oh, Black people just have different genetics or whatever the case is. So I think that's just very important. Like, you've got to factor in, you know, the class factor, or it's going to lead you down some very strange places. And I, and again, these kinds of issues, you know, sorry, my headphone, headphones never stick in my ear. I don't know, something wrong with the size of my ear, but, again, as I said, like, you know, if we find that, like, sure, there should not be like, there should not be barriers to Black people being doctors and wannabe, or there should not be this disproportionate gap. But I would hate to see that really distract from the fundamental issue of like, I mean, do we want to talk about more Black doctors, or do we want to talk about like universal healthcare, which would, again, by far be the thing that would improve healthcare disparities by race, you know?
And financing education, like, who are, who's victimized disproportionately by the predatory student loan system? It's, I mean, Black women typically, like, it, you address it, but you address these things like Bernie wants to, you do a tax on speculation or whatever, and you pay, and all of a sudden people don't, aren't under this sort of pressure.
Right. And now, yeah. And I was going to say, I actually remember in 2020, I think it was during a debate, this issue was raised, and Bernie, I think, handled it well, where he was, you know, he said like, yes, we need more Black doctors, but like, guess what is a huge barrier to many Black students being doctors, the high cost of education. And of course, if you're becoming a doctor, I mean, that's, you know, an insane cost of education. So something like universal higher education, I'm sure would create way more diverse pool of doctors, you know, because you're going to get more people actually able to do the profession. So again, I think things like this kind of just take our eye off the ball of like, what would actually be the meaningful solution? And, you know, I don't know, maybe it's partly, it's just people don't believe we'll be able to win the bigger thing. So let's focus on this like more narrow thing. But again, why it concerns me is that it just kind of like distracts from the main issue and the main solution that would actually really address the problem.
Yeah, I think 100%. Well, Paul, before we get you out of here, I have to ask our good friend Labor Paul. I mean, you know, difficult things, I think, going on politically, internationally, as we all know. But like, the one silver lining has been just like these big wins for unions across the country. And you know, we'll be watching, as I'm sure most folks will, the results of this expansion now, this like campaign in the South from Sean Fain and the UAW. I'm just curious. I mean, like, is our optimism well grounded here, Paul, about where we stand?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. I mean, the UAW stuff is incredible, and it's also such a great proof of concept for, you know, people who are dedicated to reforming the labor movement and institutions like Labor Notes. I mean, this was the whole idea, is like, if you can change leadership, you can take on the corporate class and start winning. Not only are you going to win more for existing union members, but you're going to be able to do new organizing. And the UAW has just proven that right across the board. You know, their big three stand up strike showed auto workers what you can get. And remember, I mean, Volkswagen, where they won in April, they tried, I think, three times in the last decade before to organize Volkswagen and failed. And I think clearly it was because, you know, different leadership, different approach. And also they didn't have a big strike where they had a big win to be able to show workers what you can get. Now, I think Mercedes is going to be a little bit tougher. They're doing more overt union busting. I don't know when that vote's being announced, this end of this week. But yeah, I mean, this is cause definitely for optimism. You know, another thing to think about too is, in the medium to long term, this could actually really remake the political map of the South. You know, if you have more union members, and, you know, now you have this union, which is also a political machine. I mean, unions if you weaponize it, if you deal with the infrastructure correctly, can turn these unions into an electoral force. So, I mean, if this keeps going, I don't want to get ahead of myself, but the medium to long term, they keep winning in the South, this could remake the electoral map in the South. So, you know, this is all great stuff happening. You know, UAW, I think, is the top thing happening, but there's other exciting things going on, you know, in the Teamsters. There's a lot of grad student organizing. And, you know, I do hear some people say, I mean, we should keep in mind, like, yes, this is happening, but union density has not improved. This is true, but also it's like, I don't think we should have ever expected, like, oh, the UAW will strike once, or there'll be some strikes, and all of a sudden that same year, we're going to see a 10% spike in union density. Like, that was never realistic to expect. We're seeing what I hope is the beginning of a wave that could lead to that. So yes, it's true right now, union density still has not moved, but I think it's still early. But you know, UAW is showing the way, and they're showing that there is a hunger out there for unions. I could also say, you know, within the Teamsters, there are leaders saying that, you know, 10 years ago, we were desperate for leads. Now we can't even keep up with people reaching out to us wanting to organize a union. So this is a moment, and I think UAW is doing the right thing. They're saying, let's go with the momentum. You know, let's not do before. The idea was like, well, we methodically go one plant by one plant and take 2 years each time. This is kind of a different moment. And they're like, let's ride this wave as long as we can. And, you know, so far at Volkswagen, they were proved correct. Hopefully they will be at Mercedes. But, you know, I think that there's genuine reason to be optimistic. You know, we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves, but it's like the only thing keeping me hopeful right now.
I mean, and it's also, I just like, you know, everyone loves a guy who calls their shots, and like the thing is, like, the, you know, the UAW, like, setting these big targets and hitting them, I have to say, is like one of the more inspiring things that we've seen in a long while. And look, I you know, I totally think, I don't want to get too ahead of ourselves, but the Southern strategy, you think about how vacant the Democratic Party is in states like Alabama and states like Texas, frankly, how weak those apparatuses are. If you can actually create a kind of political coalition around, you know, a mobilized labor movement, a growing labor movement, boy, I mean, you could really start moving some things very, very quickly, because it becomes very clear when Kay Ivey and the rest of these folks are all lining up against the union, lining up against all these working people, the Republican Party has no interest in everyday folks.
And, you know, even, I mean, bringing it back to this conversation of institutional racism, you know, our industrial workforce looks so different today than it did. I mean, if you just look at videos from the picket lines of the Big Three strike and the videos coming out from the UAW organizing these new plants, again, you're going to see, like, heavily Black workforce, the Southern auto workforce. Again, it's just, it's not the 1950s anymore. So, I mean, inherently built into this is, you know, economic empowerment for Black workers, which, again, hopefully can translate into political power. You know, so to me, this is also just fundamental to that project. Well, and, you know, the UAW actually does have a long, I also wrote about this, like, they have a long, rich history of, you know, civil rights activism and improving, you know, the economic condition of auto workers. So, you know, they really have this potential to kind of remake the South if they can keep this going.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, Paul, it's always, you know, such an honor and pleasure to speak with you, friend. I mean, people should definitely be subscribing to Damage Magazine to read your piece. Also, really great pieces from Dustin Costella. Ben Fong has a really cool piece about Oddfellows. A lot of really great, Matt Huber. I don't know. I love everyone in Damage is great. I'm not going to read the entire list of this issue, but really people should be subscribing to Damage Magazine. Anything else, Paul, that you wanted to mention or plug to folks before we let you go?
Yeah, you know, I'm at Jackman, still writing there. But yeah, I would just say, like, let's pray for the UAW this week. That's my main hope this week.
Well, hell yeah, friend. Well, hope to talk to you soon.
All right. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul.
That was great. And seriously, people should read the piece. It's really excellent, and obviously keep up with everything going on at Jacobin Magazine. We're actually be talking a little bit about the
and UAW. Damage, which that piece is in.
Just of course. How can I forget? We're going to be talking a little bit about the UAW in just a little bit in the postgame. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning. Get access to that, along with some other fun stuff. Some surprise I forgot to mention to you, Matt. So we're going to have a lot going on there. But before we get over there, we got to talk about this Texas story, Matt, because it really is something. I have a pretty thick skin when it comes to Texas politics, and don't get me wrong, I'm mad as hell, but I just know that these guys are going to take every single opportunity to do the nastiest and most damaging thing for everyday Texans here. This one really did send me. So I want to get to the highlight here, but I have to give people just a small amount of history. I know everyone who's been a dedicated Left Reckoner will know this history, but maybe if you're seeing this video for the first time, Greg Abbott and the Republican Party, well, parts of the Republican Party, the big donors in the Republican Party, have been trying to push a school privatization scheme on Texas, something that has been massively unpopular with Texans, even Republican voters in this state, particularly with rural Republicans, because the schools end up being very important parts of the community, very important parts of the economy, socially. We all know Friday Night Lights. We all know high school football here in Texas. Big damn deal. And people love their schools, right? And this is why, by the way, the Republican Party has done all these attacks on LGBTQ rights and things like this, because they've been trying to paint this picture that teachers, who are extremely popular all across the country, are somehow dangerous and bad and wicked. Don't ever take your eye off the ball at the Republican Party. This is why they drum up these kind of culture panics. Anyway, they've been attempting to push school voucher program in Texas. Greg Abbott, who basically has control of the Republican Party, has been pushing really damn hard, and it got blocked by a small coalition of some rural Republicans who fought back against the Republican Party because their constituents were telling them they didn't want it. Now, Abbott did something really damn cynical, which was in that last legislative session, tied $6 billion in school funding to a school privatization bill. And he did that so he can say, look how much these people say they like schools. I promised to fund them. They didn't take it. And now all these bad things are happening to schools. Well, we're in a big, having a lot of problems with schools across the state of Texas when it comes to funding. So Republican members of the state government have asked Greg Abbott to call a special session. That's how you get things done in Texas, so that they can fund public schools in Texas. Greg Abbott released this letter on Twitter just yesterday. Texas House Democrats joined a handful of Republicans to kill our education package last year. It had $6 billion for school funding, including teacher pay raises and school safety, blah, blah, blah. Basically holding this money and saying, no, we won't do a special session. So we're not going to fund the schools. All the bad things that are happening to schools, all the bad things that are happening to our children here in the state of Texas, that's their fault. Now, let's just note two quick things here. One, there's no reason to tie school funding to Greg Abbott's fetish for school privatization. And we'll get into why that's a big problem in just a second. Two, Texas, for people who don't know, hell, a lot of Texans don't know this, has a $30 billion budget surplus, meaning they've been taking money out of your pocket. They've been taxing money out of Texans' pockets. And it's just sitting there while kids are being told that programs are being shut down for them, schools are having to do layoffs, all this kind of stuff. Well, there's money just sitting right here in Austin. There's plenty of money to go around for schools in Texas. Another big problem is all of these tax schemes that the Republican Party has been doing to pull money out of the school districts. But that's neither here nor there. We can do a whole episode on the problem of the Republican Party when it comes to schools. I just wanted to set this up, set the stage for this next story here, because it is truly shocking. So again, Greg Abbott's been doing all this to push school privatization in the state of Texas. Now, this is all happening as in Houston, HISD, which is the eighth largest school district in the country, has been undergoing a massive transformation as the state has taken over custody of this independent school district. Now, they took over the HISD, citing a bad performance from some of these schools, and they put in this guy named Mike Miles. Mike Miles was up in Dallas for a while, but before that, Matt, do you think this is somebody who spent a long time as a public school teacher and sort of worked their way up the ranks?
Oh, Mikey Miles? Sounds pretty cool. I don't know. It's a cool name.
No, this is a charter school fella who founded a bunch of charter schools up in Colorado. Charter schools, by the way, which have had major issues, underperforming, some of the worst performing out there, massive budget shortfalls, among other issues. Now, this is all anyways, this charter school guy comes over, takes over HISD. Again, it's already a story enough in itself, because he takes over the school district, starts encouraging more discipline, students, more punishment for students, pulling kids out of the classroom.
Hey, let's get a businessman in there. See what a businessman can do to the school district.
Well, like a businessman looking at great educational organizations like Prager University to get those materials in to educate the students, right? So again, what's been going on in HISD, we could do a whole episode on what's going on there. But this has been a crisis in Houston. People have been very upset because this guy is pushing a $450 million of cuts across HISD because of these budget shortfalls. So again, we got money from the state. The state's not willing to play ball. But now we have a charter school guy sitting on top of the eighth largest in the country school district, overseeing massive cuts, layoffs, and PragerU indoctrination for our students here in the Houston area. You will never believe what is revealed by the Spectrum News investigation, Matt. Because talking about Mike Miles, as I noted before, charter school guy who founded a bunch of schools up in Colorado, schools called the Future Schools, which is very worrying when you think about what the Republican Party is trying to do to our schools here in Texas. He actually, even though those schools have been having major problems in Colorado, he opened up three more in the state of Texas in the past few years, in Odessa, in Midland, Texas, and a middle school, I believe, right here in Austin. Now, this story comes out from Spectrum News about some very weird things that have been going on with the budgets of these schools in Texas, these charter schools in Texas, and these charter schools in Colorado. Let's play. This is from Spectrum News. It truly is shocking.
The administration is asking to do.
In 2020,
so just a quick, that's him in a board meeting. He is now the superintendent of the Houston Independent School District, but he's still attending board meetings for this private company, for this charter school company, as a consultant. Okay? So that matters here, because watch what happens next.
The administration is asking to do.
In 2020, around the time his financial troubles were beginning in Colorado, Miles began expanding his charter school network to Texas. First Midland Sam Houston Elementary, then Ector College Prep in Odessa, then Austin Mendez Middle School. But by the end of the 2023 school year, as he was taking over in Houston, Miles' three Texas schools were nearly $2.7 million in the red. So why were Miles' new Texas schools losing money? Third Future Schools' 2023 audit shows of the $25 million public tax dollars being spent on Miles' three Texas schools, $15 million was spent on teachers and supplies. The other $10 million, about 40% of the entire budget, was spent on unspecified administrative costs and services.
Jesus.
Spectrum News made multiple requests over the course of several months for a detailed accounting of those administrative expenses. Third Future Schools never responded. However, included in publicly available financial audit records were the auditor's notes revealing that the deficits were documented as being due to other Third Future Network schools outside of Texas and to Third Future Schools corporate in Colorado. Again, TFS Colorado declined to provide us with an explanation of why so many Texas public school dollars were being transferred to school operations in another state.
What's with those dollars flying? Can you show that again? I just want to show those. It's a great little...
It is odd. I know.
His public school dollars were being transferred to school operations in another state.
Flying straight over.
Flying straight over, also odd looking dollars, but I don't want that to overshadow what's revealed there. I mean, so this Spectrum News report, I mean, is making it seem abundantly clear that Miles's charter schools are taking Texas public money and funneling them to these charter schools in Colorado. It is almost too perfect. Is it a metaphor? No. It is almost too perfect of an example why we need to keep these private hands as far away from our public money as possible. I'm sorry. Look, I'm all about helping each other out and looking out for one another, but there is no goddamn reason that the state of Texas should be subsidizing education in Colorado, let alone, hey, it'd be one thing if maybe we're sending some money over to some public schools, let alone to go and fund charter school operations in the state of Colorado. And the fact that the person who founded these schools, who's part of these board meetings, calling these kind of shots of these shady dealings with literally millions of dollars of taxpayer money, is sitting on top of the Houston Independent School District, is a complete travesty for education, for the future of Texas, and for democracy. Because let's not forget that the only reason he is in that position is not because the people of Houston wanted him to be there. It's because the state Republican Party imposed him on the people of Houston, and specifically chose somebody who has a background in bilking money from the public to put into the hands of private operators.
Yeah, and you know, this is a good sort of gravestone to put on this era where we act like people who are looking to make a profit are going to innovate the concept of school, which is rather old, I would just suggest. Instead, what they're going to innovate is this sort of thing where we funnel cash around is like criminals. I mean, that's the innovation.
It's a tremendous innovation, right, Matt? Found a way to hide things in the budget as $10 million. I mean, Lord help us all. If Matt's looking through the left reckoning, you know, payout, that he just sees $15,000 administrative costs.
Going to Damage Magazine. I'm like, what the hell, David?
Oh, man. I mean, it really is something else. And also, let's not forget the consequences in the context of this are, one, Republicans who have been getting wined and dined, spending time with a bunch of financial interests who were trying to bring this, make this a statewide problem, imposing one of these freaks on the largest city in the state of Texas and the eighth largest school district in the country, so that they can get more of their friends bilking money from the government, right? And while all this is going on, we have our tyrant governor straight up withholding money from children because he wants to make a political point to Republican members of his of the legislature, because they didn't want a bunch of weird assholes showing up to our public schools across the state of Texas and taking money, sending out to California, sending it out to Pennsylvania, sending out to New York, putting it in their own bank account. It is an absolute travesty. And if the Democratic Party had any sense, this would be, hell, not just a Texas story, but a national story. We'll see. Hopefully they have enough folks and some people who have the vision to make this the number one issue. Remind people what the Republican Party wants to do to schools.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I hope that Democrats have gotten rid of this charter school thing. Honestly, Trump was useful. I don't think his administration was good for a lot in many parts of the world, let alone ours. But I will say, the heat he put on charter school Democrats, being like, which side are you on? Those people got smoked out a little bit, and hopefully, I mean, that would be, because this is such an easy opportunity. It's going to another state, millions of dollars to educate our kids, and you're funneling it because you can't run your businesses correctly. It should, like, we saw, like, right-wing parents upset about Drake's story time. Like, people mm-hmm. should be, like, throwing rocks through the window, metaphorically speaking, of course. But, like, this is an insane, I mean, just offense to everything that a society should hold decent, is like not taking money from kids because your scammer has, you know, different plans for it.
Yeah. It's another day in the great state of Texas, unfortunately, though. But we'll keep our eyes on this and keep covering what's going on in Houston, because it is quite shocking and important. And frankly, a pretty worrying example of something that's happening all across the country, which is public goods that belong to all of us getting cut up, chopped up for the benefit of the few.
It's the enclosure, folks. It always comes. Enclosure's coming for you.
Folks, you're not going to want to miss the post game. Patreon.com/Left Reckoning. Matt and I are going to do a little preview of the UAW move in Alabama. We got some other fun stuff. Matt, what's that?
Bill Maher. We got to do Bill Maher. Ooh. And
Bill.
Bill Burr. Yeah.
Very, very good one there. We might have a surprise clip as well. We'll have to see what we're doing for time. And we'll also be taking y'all's questions from the Discord. So come over patreon.com/Left Reckoning, support the show. We'll be back this Sunday with the bonus episode. See all of y'all very soon, and come in the postgame.
Peace.